and gentlemen, Your Excellency, Dr. Hossein Al-Amiri, the Iraqi ambassador to Australia. Thanks everybody for coming here today. And it's my great pleasure to be able to introduce Major General Roger Noble, somebody who I've known for 30 years. And if I had to have somebody here who is what we consider to be a thinking man's general, then I couldn't think of anybody better than Roger. We could probably spend 25 minutes reading Roger's CV, but just to give you some of the highlights and some of the reasons why we have chosen him in particular to come here and talk. Roger is an Armoured Corps officer and a cavalry officer by trade, and he's commanded at the troop, squadron and regimental level and has been the commander of the 3rd Brigade in Townsville. He's been on 6 operational deployments. He's deployed to East Timor. He's deployed to Afghanistan. But more particularly for our purposes here today, he's deployed to Iraq on 3 occasions, first in 1992 as a team leader with the United Nations chemical weapons team. In 2005, see, he's gone already. I'll keep on going while he's not here. In 2005, he deployed as the commander of the 1st Australian Task Group to Al-Muthanna in southern Iraq. And he has just returned from 12 months in Iraq, where he served as the Deputy Coalition Force Land Commander as a brigadier working to the commander of the US 101st Airborne Division. So Roger has been to Iraq in 1992 under Saddam Hussein. He's been there in 2005 at the height of the fighting, and he returned in 2016. So he can put things into context for us. At the same time, he's not only an excellent and experienced soldier, but Roger also has a master's degree in public policy from the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Washington. And he is currently studying for a PhD, which he said he started in 2010, which means you should be timed out by now, shouldn't you, Roger? Yeah. He was promoted to Major General in November last year, and given he has spent so much time amongst palm trees, the Australian Army saw it fit to give him some more time under palm trees, but this time in Hawaii, where he is being posted within the next month as a Deputy Army Commander Pacific.
Deputy Commanding General.
Deputy Commanding General Army Forces Pacific in Hawaii for the next 2 years. So I'd like you all to give a very generous welcome to Roger Noble, and he'll speak for about 20 minutes or so, at the end of which we'll take some questions, and I'll just give you some of the kind of parameters the constraints that Roger as a serving military officer is under before we get into the questions. So thanks very much, Roger.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real honour and a pleasure to be here. I'm going to read my presentation. I don't hate doing that, actually. It doesn't work with soldiers. But I'm going to do it because what I'm talking about is important and I want to get the message right. But clearly at the end, ask any questions that you have. And I'll get to the map in a minute so that you're familiar with Iraq. But in Baghdad on the 8th of March 2016, the headquarters US 82nd Airborne Division conducted a transfer of authority with the headquarters 101st Airborne Division air assault. From that date, the Screaming Eagles assumed the lead for the Coalition Land Force in Iraq operating against Daesh, and in direct support of the Iraqi Security Force-led combat operations to liberate Iraq and militarily defeat Daesh. At the time, I was particularly honoured and lucky to be appointed as a deputy commander of the 19-nation Coalition Land Force. And the division subsequently conducted a 9-month tour in Iraq, which concluded on the 17th of November 2016. My purpose today is to provide you a brief insight into the conduct and progress of combat operations in Iraq in 2016. It's an amazing story of sustained Iraqi-led tactical military success against a difficult and ruthless enemy operating with few, if any, limits on either their behaviour or actions. I'll conclude with some personal observations that I assess have potentially enduring military tactical relevance to the ADF as it continues to face the challenges of the 21st century. They're my views, not the Department of Defence's. But I'll throw them out there. I would stress that my talk today is military and tactically focused on combat operations in Iraq in 2016. Feel free to ask any questions you like, but understand my focus and area of experience. I'll not directly specifically discuss the Australian contribution in any great detail, but you will see our efforts were well nested into the campaign plan, that they directly and materially contributed to progress in 2016. It's worth beginning with a short discussion about the situation in Iraq in 2016 and the nature of the coalition mission. Throughout 2016, we were continually struck by the number or the tendency to make assumptions about the situation in Iraq based on previous experience. And the world, especially the coalition world, is full of previous experience in Iraq. Some things are clearly the same, such as the geography and the nature of the climate. It's not a comment on climate change. Just pointing out the basic operating conditions are pretty much the same. Wickedly hot summer. Many of the people, the issues, the social, cultural and political character of Iraq were consistent and immediately recognisable. However, for the coalition, it was a significantly different mission and a contribution inside a markedly different context. We faced an enemy that had seized ground and was essentially fighting a conventional defence, primarily around occupied urban centres. The Iraqis and the coalition were not fighting a counterinsurgency, although elements of that fight existed throughout. But rather, this is a requirement for large-scale, joint, conventional offensive operations. By way of example, during the first 2 weeks of the Mosul offensive, the coalition alone carried out 106 strike missions, each with multiple engagements, employing 2,250 munitions in and around the city of Mosul. The campaign required large-scale ground combat forces. They just weren't coalition forces. It was the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish security forces. The coalition did not have a ubiquitous ground presence in Iraq. We weren't everywhere and we didn't know everything. We relied heavily on the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people for information, understanding and advice. Critically, this was an Iraqi-led and executed offensive operation conducted under the direction of the Iraqi government. Gone was the previous coalition capacity and mandate to conduct our own ground combat operations, circa my last tour in 2005, where we could do things independently. We often did it with the Iraqi security force, but we often drove it. So in 2016, the coalition role was advise, assist Iraqi security forces, train and equip them to defeat Daesh and provide fires, intelligence, logistic support to enable their successful combat operations. The key point about 2016 Iraq was the genuine coalition nature of the fight. A term that I heard bandied around a lot in Iraq was proxy war, which is a particularly arrogant term. But about 3 months in, a very senior coalition officer quipped wryly with a smile on his face, "I came here to fight a proxy war, and it took me 3 months to realise I was the proxy." So my point is, it's a bad term. And I think you hit a key point. Nobody was anyone's proxy. Or, alternatively, everybody was everybody's proxy. Take your pick. In my view, the term has little utility and is inaccurate. The defeat of Daesh required collaboration built around shared but not identical interests. It was a true, genuine coalition partnership, where success relied on genuine, direct, open communication and a constant dialogue reliant on listening, patience and empathy. This is harder than it might sound, especially for Taipei mission-orientated military organisations. It's true that one of the key characteristics of this type of environment is endless frustration, on all sides, by all ranks. But perversely, it is kind of good for everybody involved. And luckily, the Iraqis have a bottomless jug of chai, which everyone can drink and discuss any difficult issues. Turning to the enemy, to my mind, based on what I saw on a day-to-day basis, and I saw it up close, the old legal term for pirates fits them best. Hostis humani generis, the enemy of all mankind. I don't like them. Their conduct and behaviour towards the populations they controlled, the ISF, and their own people, literally defies belief from any belief system. As the 101st assumed the coalition lead, The enemy had just suffered a seminal tactical defeat with the loss of Ramadi City in the Al Anbar province after a bitter, extended and highly destructive fight culminating in December 15. The time we got there, Daesh retained the ability to mass forces, company to battalion plus, 50 to 100 men, for deliberate tactical combined arms offensive operations, which they employ a diverse range of conventional and improvised weapons systematically against the ISF. They retain a capacity to seize and hold ground. Over the period of March to November, this capacity was systematically targeted and significantly degraded. By the time of the commencement of the Mosul counterattack, Daesh had effectively lost the capacity to seize and hold ground inside Iraq and had been forced into a defence in urban areas and was limited to the conduct of small-scale local counterattacks. That's a big change. And when confronted with the ISF, and I include the Kurdish security forces, and supported by the coalition, the enemy would be defeated in close combat. This did not happen by chance and was the product of detailed planning and the comprehensive application of all available 21st century means to close with, destroy, disrupt, and degrade the Daesh capacity and will to fight. The coalition plan was focused on four principal lines of effort. The first line was to support Iraqi security force manoeuvre to defeat Daesh, primarily through the provision of advice and assistance at the key command nodes in the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish security forces. This network also focused on synchronising the application of intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, strike and logistic support to the Iraqis in the execution of their plan. Australian Special Forces played an important role in this line through their support to the Iraqi Counter-Terrorism Service, the elite assault infantry of the Iraqi Security Force. Now, Hornets and the other RAF assets played a meaningful, direct, daily role in the provision of strike and information support on this line of effort. I can personally vouch for that. The second line of effort was to support ISF development, which was sharply focused on the force generation of combat capabilities required to defeat Daesh. This was different from previous times in Iraq. It was characterised by a laser-like focus on developing the ISF units designated to fight Daesh and to hold the liberated area. The availability of sufficient quality troops able to close with the enemy and win and then hold the ground that was won was pivotal to gaining and sustaining success. On this line, our task group Taji played a leading role as one of the key force generating hubs at Taji and assisted in building a combined arms force, infantry, armour, combat engineers, artillery, fires that could beat Daesh in the close combat fight. These units would eventually, that we helped train, but the rest of the coalition did as well, would eventually clear Fallujah, Heat, Rutba, and by the time we left, commence the attack on Mosul, while simultaneously protecting Baghdad and all of the newly liberated areas. During the period March to October, the coalition trained 11 Iraqi Army combat brigades, plus multiple units of the Peshmerga and Iraqi Special Forces. Without this force, Daesh could not be defeated. The third line of operation was to protect the force and maintain the coalition. This was my commanding general's highest priority. As with all large coalition forces, the Blue Force has high internal complexity. It's not a homogenous thing, 19 nations. And it takes time and investment to sustain the unity of effort and purpose. Protecting the soldiers, the sailors, the airmen and the Marines, both physically and in a reputational sense, plus the force protection of the Iraqi combat forces, was absolutely central to this mission and was a priority we never compromised and never wavered on. The last line, potentially the most interesting, was the inform and influence line of effort, which was ubiquitous and critical to underpinning the narrative battle against Daesh. Clausewitz was dead right. Who knows who Clausewitz is? Read his book, Dead German. First five books on war. War is a clash of wills. It's about here and here. And it's a free creative act. It is ultimately a human activity and rests on what the participants, i.e. the people, not the platforms, believe and understand. Contesting and winning the clash of ideas, informing and influencing the population, building and sustaining consensus, and defeating the highly effective enemy propaganda system was central to building confidence and belief inside Iraq throughout 2016. Integrating this effort with everything else, the ground manoeuvre plan and the kinetic side, was central to our method. We did it by, with and through the Iraqis, who were largely directed, controlled and put the limits around how that worked. The outcomes in 2016 inside Iraq are best left to speak to themselves, so I'll just lay it out to you and you can look at the map. ISF efforts to advance and clear the Euphrates River Valley steadily accelerated through 2016, with the ISF securing the valley, both north and south of the river, all the way to Aditha and out to Rutba by November. The ISF, in close cooperation with the Peshmerga and the KSF, conducted a multi-divisional advance west and north, including a critical assault river crossing of the Tigris to secure the Kiara airfield and the city of Kiara as a key staging base to enable the attack on Mosul. Meanwhile, the Peshmerga and KSF held and expanded the Kurdish defence line, setting the conditions for the subsequent Mosul counterattack while constantly reducing Daesh combat power. The Iraqis then quickly advanced and concentrated forces in close cooperation with Kurds to position forces for a multi-axis attack on Mosul, which began, as was planned, months before, on the 17th of October. During our 9 months, frankly, it was planned for the 15th, but it started on the 17th. Pretty good. During our 9 months in Iraq, the ISF, supported by the coalition, liberated an estimated 250,000 Iraqis and took back 60% of the land that had been taken by Daesh inside Iraq. The coalition offensive contribution was to conduct sustained kinetic and non-kinetic attack against Daesh across the battlefield, both inside and outside Iraq. The big thing we put into it was pressure. The Americans would call it an all-court press onto the enemy, wherever he was, whatever he was doing, targeting the key pieces of his combat power and ability, his leaders, special military capabilities like rockets, chemical weapons production. The gains against Daesh in the information realm were also significantly improved and synchronised in 2016. They were made in concert with and around the ground tactical manoeuvre successes of the ISF in a singular integrated effort. So in the 21st century, there's not army guys doing fighting and everybody else. It's all together as one effort against the enemy. The Iraqis are very good at this, and they only got better and better. And one of the smartest people I met in Iraq, a British civilian expert in information operations, said to me early, the Daesh narrative must be contested. As soon as it is consistently and widely contested, we will start to win the narrative contest inside Iraq, and we will start to win the war. My belief is we started to see that last year. From March to November 16, we assessed the Daesh propaganda output inside Iraq was reduced by approximately 50%. We observed a steady growth in confidence in the ISF and a corresponding decrease in support for Daesh. While this is difficult to definitively measure, indicators revealed a consistent positive trend line. For example, during combat operations in the Euphrates River Valley in September, social media criticism of Daesh outpaced critical coverage of the ISF by 75-1. It's just an indicator. The impact on the Daesh narrative was also very clear. There was a definitive shift away from messaging focusing on life in the caliphate and the importance of physically holding ground towards what we called martyrdom themes. The advantages of getting yourself killed in action. This is a complicated dynamic area that is both critically important and always challenging. And the impact of the modern world in this space is profound and complex. November 16 saw Daesh in defence of the iconic dual capital, Mosul. There's always a debate about what's more important, Mosul or Raqqa. Mosul's central. And everyone knows how that defence will end, friend and foe alike. The days of black flag fleets of Daesh technicals streaming down Iraqi roads were over. and requires those who continue to use these images to dig deep into file footage. So I've got a few points to end on, general observations that are mine that I took from that experience that I'd extrapolate out as being relevant more generally to the idea. The first is a clinical dispassionate look at Daesh, which is hard, but looking at them as a generic enemy. Daesh has proven to be highly motivated, well-led, an effectively organised, unconstrained enemy. When this style of human organisation is combined with contemporary weapons, everyday technology, and the ubiquitous information environment of the modern world, a highly lethal adversary can be generated. Daesh is a salutary lesson in the power of innovation, as is shown in the use of their vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices as surrogate tanks, small-scale mobile chemical weapons production, improvised rocket range extension, global branding and information operations, floating refrigerator-borne improvised exploding device, one of my favourites, the use of off-the-shelf unmanned aerial systems, and the use of commercial software to target, track and communicate. They have shown us that a hybrid enemy can fight with a power and impact that is potentially similar to or state-like. Conventional forces can be legitimately challenged if unprepared and in the right context. This use of technologies and ideas is an option potentially open to any similar non-state 21st century actor operating elsewhere. Expect to see more of it. The armed forces of states need to be ready to deal with this style of innovative, ruthless enemy and to deal with what I call the Daesh equation. I'm not a mathematician, my first equation. Motivation plus innovation plus the modern world equals high threat capable adversary. The second observation is the key to success when confronted with such an adversary is the force able to plan and execute modern joint combined arms operations. That includes the capacity to field a first world close combat capability. I'll translate that in English now. So an effective force may be able to source, understand, and apply the full set of available relevant capabilities. Kinetic, our cultural preference, but also non-kinetic, military capabilities, but also non-military capabilities, and put it all together in a coherent package. It is no longer 1945. Unsurprisingly, one of my favourite movies is Fury, just because I'm a tank guy. And while the key updated capabilities of armour, infantry, combat engineers and fires remain the close combat coin of the realm, they must now be reinforced, amplified, and integrated with globally sourced intelligence, surveillance, strike, and influence tools. So a company commander in Band of Brothers, 101st, now Band of Brothers and Sisters, in combat in 2017, the captain will be drawing on globally sourced information and support tools well outside his immediate sphere of, or her immediate sphere of influence. The warfighting team is diverse, and a joint approach is manifestly the essential base requirement for any professional 21st century force. Part of the joint combined arms approach must be the maintenance of a first world close combat capability. Some of you will think that's a tank guy, of course he's going to say that. It is absolutely essential. You've got to be able to fight and win against this style of enemy in complex urban terrain or everything stops. Central to success in Iraq was the ISF's capacity and willingness to close with and destroy Daesh, who were fighting from well-prepared defensive positions in complex urban terrain. The last 600 metres in front of the enemy in urban terrain remains the most testing and dangerous place on earth, and success in that space rests squarely on the quality of leadership and the proficiency of the armed force, which should have first-rate survivable combat systems, immediate access to high fidelity intelligence and precision fires. If you give the team that, they'll win. The ISF showed that. There are no shortcuts. The cost of failure is high. All actions are high risk. There is yet no way around this basic requirement when faced with the challenges posed by Daesh-like enemies operating in urban or complex terrain. Last point. Final observation is that the quality of our people is decisive. It is the most important thing. That's my personal belief. While I get the old military axiom that mass has a quality all of its own, I would contend without quality people, any 21st century force will seriously struggle with most of the likely mission sets we'll face. The complexity of the modern world, the challenge of effectively integrating so many new, old and emerging capabilities just reinforces the point. Professional military training, but especially military education and critical thinking, remains of paramount importance. The modern military leader and combatant must be a knowledgeable, disciplined, morally and mentally prepared professional, able to solve complex problems and listen to anybody and deal with any organisation or agenda. Seen the old movie Patton? I think that model might be out of date. My own view is that listening, empathy, self-awareness, imagination and relentless curiosity will increasingly become essential traits of the future successful military leaders and actors in the 21st century. And that's a big deal for armies. This all takes time, focus and systematic effort, and unfortunately there are no shortcuts with that. This is not to underplay the critical importance of technology, because you need that as well, but just to emphasise that the better people you've got, you'll probably get the best technology you can and they'll use it in an optimal way. So that concludes my point. I'd just like to say one thing, which is respect for the fallen, Coalition, ISF and Kurdish. All of them who fought Daesh. So I'd just like to say that publicly.
Thanks. Listen, thanks very much, Roger. Now, we've got about 25 minutes for questions, and obviously Roger is a serving Army officer, so he's a bit restricted in what he can answer, so any kind of political questions are probably going to be well outside his remit. That having been said, there is a whole wealth of questions that he can answer and is more than willing to answer, but when people do ask a question, if you can just raise your hand and we'll bring a microphone around, if people can just state their name and their affiliation. But I'll just, sorry, Your Excellency, I'll probably drop in on first. Yes, certainly. What we'll do is Iraqi Ambassador would just like to say a few words, which we'll allow him to. Sir, if you just want to wait for the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. In front of you, I want to thank Major General Roger twice. First, for his fantastic and great talk, which is very important. And second is his support and his backup to Iraqis, in addition to the Australian troops, is highly appreciated for us. Thank you very much, Major General. Now I want to give some comments. One of them, ISIS. Are they Muslims? No. They took Islam and Islam principles as cover. They have nothing to do with the Islamic principles. I want to give comment about the popular mobilization. We hear here and there that they are militias. They are not really. They are part of our military division. They are approved by the parliament as part of the army. There were some failures done within the war at the beginning. And this is happens in every battle and every war. And they were, the people who made this failure were prosecuted. They are working under the command of the Prime Minister as all military divisions. In addition, I want to say just one question. Is the fighting of Daesh process clean or not? It is strictly spoken by the General Command, the Prime Minister, It is not allowed to shoot civilian, although they are used as umbrella by the ISIS. It is not allowed at all. You can wait. Accordingly, the liberation of the right side of Mosul will take place because it is heavily lived by civilians, so that they are preparing and finding ways to save the civilians before hitting Daesh, because they are in between the civilians. What has happened now? Another thing. What has happened later? I want to say the day after. The day after, the Major General said, and I said in the beginning, it will be cloudy. Now, there are many steps carried out to let the different conflicting people to meet each other and to work for Iraq. So we are, let's say, optimistic. Unless, and this is already said and discussed with Mr. Major General and Dr. Roger, unless the neighborhood countries interfere. Otherwise, as Iraqis, we live peacefully since long time. Different religions, multicultural, multi-religion, multi-political. So different religions, different sectors, different ethnicities, different parties, all since long time live together. I think that is all. Thank you, Dr. Roger.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joseph. Now we'll open the floor to questions just after my first question, because I'll take the privilege. And Roger, I mean, you talked about the tactical level issues. If you had to, as far as is possible, encapsulate what you believe to be the centre of gravity or the thing that Islamic State or Daesh has been able to draw its strength from, based on your observations over the last year, what do you think is the critical enabler for Daesh in Iraq?
So tactically, probably their leadership and their organisation, which we directly went after. So their human capacity to organise, motivate, and then employ the weapons that they have in an innovative way. So I was when I first got there, I was quite shocked when I saw them do a combined arms attack. I watched them do it, and it was like us. And I went, oh, this is what we're dealing with. So probably targeting the leadership at the tactical level and the things that allowed their organisation to function, like their C2 network. Then next, special military capability is the military jargon term for particular weapon systems that make them highly lethal, like rockets. But really probably the C2 in the organisation, at the tactical level, which I think, as a coalition with the Iraqi army, CTS, the Kurds, in 2016 made major inroads against that. Operationally, the next level up, it's their narrative. They had a strong brand inside Iraq, and they are masters of, we call the Iraqis, and we would call it propaganda, but actually pushing their information and their message ultra quick. So they will do an attack on an Iraqi army post. They'll film the orders. They'll conduct the attack. They'll film the attack. They'll take the post if they're lucky. They'll kill everybody there. They'll film it. They'll post it. Actually, it's often how we got our post-operational information, by looking at what the enemy put up. That's just a simple example. And then they have a powerful, you know, the black flags, the utes in the truck. So that, at the operational level, that strikes to what war's about, which is confidence and belief. So what we saw in 2016 is the Iraqis, particularly after Ramadi, begin to get onto the front foot and contest that image of power on a day-to-day basis at multiple levels. in an Iraqi way, which is not the same as us. And we helped them and augment them in putting their message back. And what we saw was a steamroller. So as your narrative contest starts, confidence builds, you have success on the battlefield, you transmit that success back into the loop. What we saw is a steady increase in support and belief in the capacity of the Iraqi security forces, and also the corresponding belief in Iraq and the ambassadors from Najaf. So on the 18th of October, there was a big meeting in Najaf by many of the leaders of the popular mobilisation force, Hashd-e-Shaabi, who don't necessarily have always seen eye to eye, would be fair to say, on a stage talking together about support for the Iraqi army, support for the liberation of Mosul, working together. So for Iraqis, they were pretty impressed with that kind of, and the Iraqis built that kind of national unity narrative contesting the brand model of Daesh inside Iraq. So that's at the operational, the key to probably ultimately defeating their ideology.
Thanks, Mark. Now, I think we had one over there first.
My name is John Murphy, I have no particular affiliation. Thank you, sir, for your talk. Much appreciate that. The ground forces are winning the battle.
Yep.
But they receive significant tactical support from the air.
Yep.
Will the ISF need to achieve its own strength in the air to be able to complete, or more to the point, maintain the gains that it makes in the longer term?
It's true. They receive a lot of support from the air. They receive a lot of fire support. A hell of a lot of it comes from the ground. So it's the combination of fires. And what the coalition can do is, through the application of precision fires in a systematic method, sets the conditions for Iraqi success and has probably sped up the entire process significantly. Now, the Iraqis, if to do close combat, you need that. Successfully against this sort of enemy, you need that kind of package. The Iraqis actually have it. So the Iraqi army, I was just talking about coalition fires in support of Mosul. The Iraqi army has artillery and rockets and helicopters. The Iraqi Air Force flies every single day and most nights in tandem as part of the coalition package. So obviously we put a weight in that is well beyond the current Iraqi capacity. But they have all the pieces of the puzzle. And they're able to apply it themselves. Obviously, a slice of the whole. So the trick for Iraq and the coalition will be to win these fights together and try and reduce Daesh to a capacity where they cannot hold ground and fight you in a conventional fight. Then there'll be another set of problems. And then hopefully the Iraqi intent is the Iraqi security force will be at a point where it can maintain its own security. Does that answer your question?
Oh, we had one over there, and then one over here.
Major General, yeah. My name is Subel. I was there in Afghanistan, Kabul, when you were deployed there. What has your experience been? How different is it from when you were deployed in Kabul? And the second one is, how involved is Australian forces in Iraq? Do you play any lead role in any of the fights, either by air or ground forces? And the change in regime in the United States, how do you think it will impact in Iraq war?
I'm going to answer the last question first. Would it be inappropriate to comment on that? Also, my next job's in the United States. So I'll leave that one. That's for the United States. The first one, I really don't like comparisons between Iraq and Afghanistan. It's like comparing Australia and Indonesia. In the West, we do it all the time, from the comfort of Washington and other places. So they're actually fundamentally different places, fundamentally different culture, different geography, which makes a significant difference, different neighbourhood and environment around it. Different enemy. The Taliban and Daesh are quite different in almost every respect. So having said that, doesn't mean that there are no similarities. Although militarily, 2012 in Kabul, 26 in Iraq, fundamentally different. One was a counterinsurgency with a big number of troops, well over 100,000 coalition troops, on the ground, partnership, training, close combat with the enemy. We were doing it with a kind of coin outcome of strengthening the entire Afghan security system. Iraq now is a conventional fight at the moment, principally, although the stabilization security force requirement as you're successful comes into play. It's conventional operations. I never thought, I was a major in 1999, I used to sit at the back of Star College looking at this hilly, wondering what the surf was like at Queenscliff, as they tried to teach me how to do a core attack. When am I ever going to do a core attack? Well, I've done 2.5. I've helped do 2.5. It was major combat operations against a different enemy in a different country on different ground. The biggest thing you draw from both is you've got to understand the context. You've got to understand where you are, what you're trying to do. And frankly, you've got to listen to people who know it better. So probably the transferable skill is this, I touched on it in my speech, you've got to soak in the actual environment that you're with, particularly when you're in somebody else's country, who they own it and are the sovereign. In both Afghanistan and Iraq, that was the same. The difference between Afghans and Iraqis is a bit like Australians and New Zealanders, or maybe more. So that's probably how I'd answer that part of the question.
General, hi. Charles Miranda from News Corp. Given your new role from next month in the Pacific, can you tell us what strategic planning or thought has been given by the ADF towards a caliphate much closer to home in the Pacific, given the fact they've now declared their caliphate for Southeast Asia? We have training camps, Daesh training camps in the Philippines, and we have hundreds and hundreds of jihadist fighters returning to the region.
Yeah, no, not yet. So I take up my appointment in March. I'm in the process of learning about what's happening in the Pacific. So I don't have any insight into the current policy or approach to the fight against violent Islamist extremists in the region that would give you any useful heads up. What you might care to do is extrapolate some of the components of the method of Iraq that I just discussed may be relevant in the region. Okay. Sorry, is that disappointing? Yeah.
Sorry, just...
I'm not going to say. See this?
Sorry, we've got this man here. Sorry.
Ask me in a year. Come visit me.
I'm Rob Thomas. I quite like your term pirates or outlaws. That's But I'd like to understand, like, given they are, let's say they are outlaws, that is it, how do you see Daesh finally being defeated? Are they going to fight to the death? Because, you know, the Wild West, the outlaws seem to, you know, the last man standing will be the way to get rid of it. Or do you see that getting rid of, you talked about the leadership, do you see getting rid of the top leadership as the way of eventually destroying Daesh?
Yeah, okay. I mean, generally people don't fight to the death. That's kind of, they do in Hollywood. And we saw with Daesh, plenty of them. Actually, one of the indicators of their morale was a pile of shaved beards. Often we would find, or the Iraqis would find, a pile of shaved beards. I'm taking this off so I can do a runner through the society. Having said that, there are elements of that organisation, like ours, who do fight to the death. So it's a human organisation. So tactically, we thought the solution was hit them on all points and message to them, the end is inevitable. This is the Iraqi idea. The end is inevitable. You are going to lose. If you fight, you will die. It's a pretty compelling message. And then you keep playing that back, which the Iraqis got better and better at doing. So wars are contests of wills. So you would find, like all armies, some units fight very hard, some don't. Some fight very well. One person gets killed, they can fall apart. Daesh are a bit like that. So I think that it'd be fair to say, as you close in on Mosul and Raqqa, their options are increasingly reduced. As the ground they hold is reduced, what do they do? Do they stay and fight? Do they go somewhere else? How does that work? So the key, we think, the Iraqis with inside Iraq, and I'll talk about that, is you've just got to keep messaging to them and to erode that, you know, we're going to stay here and kill everybody mentality that we did see on occasion. Is that an adequate answer? Yep.
We got one there. We got three on this side, which we'll go through.
Richard Muse. Yep. General, thank you for your talk. Can I ask what technologies ISIS has access to? For example, drones or potentially dirty nuclear basic devices? Because if it comes to the final suicide battle, these things could be important.
Yeah, I have no knowledge of any nuclear weapons with them. My point was about, actually they take everyday stuff that you can buy in a shop and they apply it as a weapon. So that's a weapon. Geolocating. You can take a UAV that you can buy. I saw one the other day and they sell them everywhere, actually. I thought it was like JB Hi-Fi or something. So you can take small UAVs, use software, geo-positioning software to confirm a target location. That's a simple example that Daesh would do. So really, it's about the fridge-borne IEDs. So to me, this is a brilliance of humans. I just wish they had a different worldview and applied it to something more constructive. But so the Iraqi army did a river crossing in the Tigris and identified that once we put the bridge in, Daesh is going to come from the bridge. A lot of effort was put around protecting a bridge, which was successful. But what Daesh is, how do you even get that bridge? We will take IEDs, put them in a fridge, which floats when it's taped up, and we'll just push them all out upstream. How smart is that? Like, we went, that is smart. Didn't work. But actually, it's kind of the use of everyday technology and the information they can pull and packaging it to use it like a conventional weapon. Another example that's kind of pretty important one is suicide bombers. So I don't know what your picture of a suicide bomber is. It's probably not the same as mine. So I see him as a tank round. They don't have tanks because we've pretty much shot them all. So what they do is they do what a tank does. They put on a suicide vest and they go straight down the road and they blow up the forward echelon, the advancing force. Or they get a VBID, a vehicle, and they do the same thing. So I don't have a tank. How can I gain the same effectiveness of a tank? I'll use vehicles and bombs. And we are not talking small bombs. So if you've got this kind of Hollywood, what was that movie? The Hurt Locker. The Super Hurt Locker. So we're talking semi-trailer size bombs, massive bombs. So you use that against the Iraqi army like a tank. So it's kind of taking the tools of the modern world and then packaging them and applying to achieve a convention. The other example would be IEDs. So they use IEDs different to when I was there in 05. 05, it was about trying to kill us, basically as we drove past or we went somewhere. Now they use IEDs like we would conventionally use mines in accordance with the treaty. They wouldn't. But so they use it as an obstacle. So in Ramadi, they seeded the city in IEDs, thousands and thousands, which stops a conventional force and slows it down, which lets you engage it with your tank / vehicle-borne device. So it's kind of, that's my point about here, the danger is when you're clever and you can package those things.
Sorry, we've probably just got time for two more, so one just here. Sorry, did you have?
Thank you. Carla Pincott from the Centre for Independent Studies. First of all, thank you for serving on one of the front lines of, I think, what we all realise now is a war against Western liberal values. You highlighted the differences between Afghanistan and Iraq. Obviously, there are differences on all these front lines, but what seems to be common is the ability of ISIS in whatever form, Boko Haram, the rest of them, to keep sort of metastasizing and sending out little shoots infecting societies around them. After you squash them in each area, and I'm confident you will. How difficult is it going to be to stop that, happening?
Difficult. So I'm a soldier. And I kind of hinted at it. It's more than a military fight. And I don't, you know, say this correctly. Military use of force is a key component in winning the fight, but it's not the only component. And I won't do it alone. So there needs to be I'm starting to sound like a Canberra guy. It's more than whole of government. It's like a full court press. So all of the tools available to fight, not just the individuals who are going to fight you on the next street corner in Mosul, but to fight the idea. Fight it in Sydney, you know, or fight it the radicalisation propagation method. So cleverness will be to turn success, like Iraqis have done, turn their success around and say, well, your narrative about being invincible and inevitable is patently untrue. You've just lost 60% of the ground that you took. So I think it's probably a long fight with a holistic response. Our part, the military part, is the application of force inside that wider approach. Would be how I'd answer your question. So I think against Daesh in Iraq at the moment, though, you need that. You've got to get them. You've got to destroy them, frankly, to the point where, whilst you're doing that, don't get distressed by the clever guys using everyday technology. The response to it is clever guys using everyday technology and some super good stuff. So if you package that together, we saw Iraqi army. You know, they're not like a Western army with officers and soldiers trained at this level. But they trained real hard and through experience and hard work, got themselves to a combined arms proficiency level where they could beat that problem. So here comes the VBID. I got a trained tank crewman, trained at Bethmeyer. He shoots the VBID before it gets to me. I've got infantrymen with rockets. I've got my own UAVs. I've got my artillery. I've got trained infantrymen who can shoot straight. So I think the solution is actually to play that back at them.
Listen, we've got time for one last one, and I know there are a couple more questions. Maybe Roger might be able to stay back for... So he's got time. So if you don't get through the stuff, then...
Tony Dowling, College of Radiologists. Yep.
Is it unclassified brief? So I'm not going to answer that question. The only thing I'd say to you is it's complicated and it's targeted.
Okay.
I just, in conclusion, want to thank you, Dr. John. Lewin Institute also... for our Major General and the audience. Thank you very much for this afternoon. It is a great, and for me, it is very informative. Thank you very much again, and thank you for your effort in organizing such a talk.
Thanks very much, Your Excellency. And on behalf of the Lowy Institute and on behalf of everybody here, I'm sure, it's not very often that we do hear a lot about Iraq and Syria, but it's not very often that we get to hear about it from somebody who has not only current expertise in what they're actually talking about, and on top of that, context, having served in that place three times over 20 years. So, Roger, as you would have gathered from that, is one of the more entertaining and forward thinking and opinionated officers in the Australian Army, and the fact that he's been promoted to Major General, because there are lots of opinionated officers in the Australian Army, let me tell you, but people with opinions that are backed up by experience and well thought out arguments are probably a bit rarer. Roger is certainly one of those, and I'm really glad that he came here today while he's on leave to give us his talk. So I'd just like to show you our appreciation. Thanks very much, Roger.